The Tom Woods Show, episode 1001.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Men, get yourselves an excellent shave at an outstanding price with Harry's and get your $13 trial set for free. Just cover shipping. Check it out at harrys.com/woods. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Yes, I can count. Yes, I know this is supposed to be episode 1000, but I'm coping the best I can with the fact that we had to postpone the live event for episode 1000 to September 30th. So now what am I going to do? Not put out episodes? You're going to tell a bird not to fly? Of course I'm going to keep putting out episodes, but I cannot put out a episode 1000. Episode 1000 is going to be created on September 30th before a live audience. So then we'll go back and insert episode 1000. Otherwise, what am I going to do? Do like a glum episode 1000 about woe is me. I was supposed to be with all my friends on stage for episode 1000, but here I am in my crummy house or whatever. I mean, I'm not doing that. We're just not going to do episode 1000 until we get to the live event. So we're just going on. We're moving on with our lives, you know? If you're worried about episode 1000, you're living in the past, man. We've moved on, okay? Or, I don't know, maybe, I don't know what time area you're living in, because we are going to do episode 1000 in the future. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Right now, we are on episode 1001, baby. And today, we're going to talk about Murray Rothbard and his case for radical idealism. This is an article that I will link to at tomwoods.com/what? What number is that going to be? 1001. Okay, 1001. I will link you to this. And I'm doing it because somebody asked me, why don't you share this with the audience and then maybe throw in your thoughts? So I thought, what the heck? You know, I'm sitting here depressed that there's no episode 1000. Might as well do this. Oh, that's not so. I'm in perfectly good spirits because I'm so excited about that event that I know people are going to make an extra effort to attend. TomWoods.com/Orlando is the sign-up link. All right, let's talk about Rothbard here. He is talking about how best to keep your eye on the ball as a libertarian. And he says, you know, we get accused of being utopians. We're impractical utopians who won't acknowledge the world as it exists. And we're stuck in our, you know, where our head's up there in the clouds and all we can think of is some goal that's impossible to reach. And we're completely divorced from normal politics and the normal give and take when it comes to issues like taxation and spending and government powers. Because our attitude, as many people perceive it, is that if we don't entirely get our way, then we're just not playing. And that's not Rothbard's view, but at the same time, he is saying we have to hold aloft the pure libertarian message, even if it's unlikely that in the present moment it's going to be fully implemented. If we don't uphold the full pure message, who will? Anyway, so Rothbard says we shouldn't be worried that we're gonna turn people off by being too radical. And therefore, we should hide our program. And we should therefore just take a slow, gradual approach, very slowly whittling away at state power. So, for example, when it comes to taxation, we shouldn't be advocating the abolition of all taxation or even abolishing income taxation, you know, unless we add in some other tax to substitute for it or whatever. No. Instead, these people say, we should just call for tiny improvements like a 2% cut in the income tax. So this is, and you know, maybe they don't call, you know, maybe they're not quite that wimpy, but we do know there are plenty of people who take this view that we've got to be reasonable. We can't ask for that much under the present circumstances. And Rothbard here reminds us that we ought to bear in mind, he says, the lessons of the Marxists, not because the Marxists understand how society works, but because they've been thinking about strategy for a very long time. And there are two deviations that the Marxists identified. One was left-wing sectarianism, and the other was right-wing opportunism. So the critics of libertarianism, in particular among libertarians themselves, who say we shouldn't be extremists, we should just try and get what, you know, modest improvements we can, This would be the analog of what the Marxists called right-wing opportunists. And for Rothbard, the major problem with the opportunists is that the more you focus on practical, immediate changes that have at least remote possibility of adoption, the greater the danger that you will lose sight altogether of the ultimate goal. So when you start talking about a 2% rate reduction in taxes, you can lose sight of the ultimate goal, the ultimate libertarian goal with regard to taxation. So if you concentrate only on the immediate means, you lose sight of the ultimate goal, and the ultimate goal is why you're a libertarian at all. And as Rothbard says, if libertarians refuse to hold aloft the banner of pure principle of the ultimate goal, who will? And so he says a major source of defection from the ranks in recent years has been the erroneous path of opportunism. Now, later in his article, he's going to say, now, does that mean that if a vote comes up to reduce income tax rates by 2%, that we should abstain from this or be opposed to it? Of course not. We should advocate that particular bill. So he's not, so shouldn't be misinterpreted, as he often is, as saying that I can never support any change unless it's a change to zero taxation or zero government spending. He expressly disavows that point of view later on. What he's saying now is, as our ultimate goal, like, compromise can't be your ultimate goal, or you can't start off, in other words, with really low demands. Because think of the success the left has had. The left demands everything. They want it all. And then they wind up getting 65% of what they asked for. So when we can't start off by asking for a 2% rate reduction, because in practice, what that'll simply mean is that all we'll be able to do is limit a tax increase. You know, maybe they were going to increase taxes by 15%. We call for lowering them by 2%, and maybe they wind up increasing tax rates by, you know, 11 or 12%. But what if we had been, you know, as the left is, what if we were the analog of the left on the other side and advocated, he wouldn't say 2%, he'd say 0%. Let's say we advocate 0%. At least there's somebody there pulling the conversation in the other direction, instead of simply taking for granted all the rules of the discussion and meekly advocating something that appears to be within the realm of what's acceptable. Rothbard shares a very interesting passage from Hayek, whom Rothbard himself criticized a number of times for inconsistency in upholding libertarianism. So Hayek was certainly no extremist in the Rothbardian sense. But Hayek said this, that if liberty is going to be successful, you have to hold the pure and so-called extreme ideology aloft as a never-to-be-forgotten creed. And so, for example, Hayek said that socialism was attractive to a lot of people because of the constant emphasis on the ideal goal. Even if they couldn't always achieve it at any given moment, their sights were always placed on that ideal goal. That ideal goal was very attractive to a lot of people and drew people in. Not necessarily any one particular legislative project supported by Marxists or socialists, but the whole picture, the whole vision is constantly at the forefront of their minds. And this has been quite captivating for many people. And we've got to do the same thing. Instead of saying to those of us who want to do that, hush, 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 I'm trying to do serious work here in Washington, getting, you know, 1/12 of this regulation repealed. You know, keep your stupid mouth shut. Maybe we shouldn't act like that. So anyway, here's Hayek. This is a lengthy quotation. Hayek says, "We must make the building of a free society once more an intellectual adventure, a deed of courage. What we lack is a liberal utopia." And of course, remember, liberal in this sense is meant in the European sense of classical liberalism, or more or less libertarianism. "What we lack is a liberal utopia," says Hayek, "a program which seems neither a mere defense of things as they are, nor a diluted kind of socialism, but a truly liberal radicalism, which does not spare the susceptibility of the mighty, including the trade unions, which is not too severely practical, and which does not confine itself to what appears today as politically possible. We need intellectual leaders who are prepared to resist the blandishments of power and influence, and who are willing to work for an ideal, however small may be the prospects of its early realization. They must be men who are willing to stick to principles and to fight for their full realization, however remote. Free trade and freedom of opportunity are ideals which still may rouse the imaginations of large numbers, but a mere reasonable freedom of trade or a mere relaxation of controls is neither intellectually respectable nor likely to inspire any enthusiasm. The main lesson which the true liberal must learn from the success of the socialists is that it was their courage to be utopian which gained them the support of the intellectuals and thereby an influence on public opinion, which is daily making possible what only recently seemed utterly remote. Those who have concerned themselves exclusively with what seemed practicable in the existing state of opinion have constantly found that even this has rapidly become politically impossible as the result of changes in a public opinion which they have done nothing to guide. Unless we can make the philosophic foundations of a free society once more a living intellectual issue, and its implementation a task which challenges the ingenuity and imagination of our liveliest minds, the prospects of freedom are indeed dark. But if we can regain that belief in the power of ideas which was the mark of liberalism at its best, the battle is not lost. And so Rothbard says, this is a very important truth that Hayek is emphasizing here, because it really is the case that when you stress the ultimate goal, you generate excitement and enthusiasm. Whereas who's going to go to the barricades for a 2% tax rate reduction? Take a look at the success the socialists have had, Rothbard says. They've been especially adept at the strategy he's talking about. When you look at the socialist program of, he says, 60 or even 30 years ago, you'll see that measures that were considered socialistic, dangerously socialistic, just a generation or two ago, are now part of mainstream America. And so he thinks that's because, in part, you've got the people demanding these changes, demanding an increased state and more state power, are making very, very significant demands. They're not watering their message down. And no, they don't get absolutely everything they want at the moment they demand it. But they drive the discussion in a certain direction. Their pressure pushes the framework, the 3x5 card of allowable opinion, let's say, in a particular way. And libertarians should do the same thing. Now, he doesn't point out in this essay something he points out in a later one, which is it's not clear to Rothbard, at least later in his writing, because I actually don't know when this essay was written. This might have been found in his papers or something. I actually don't know when the case for radical idealism was written. There's nothing here that indicates when he wrote it, so I actually don't know the provenance of it. But in a later essay, he says it's not clear that the state can be, that state power can be diminished in the same way that it was introduced. So that is to say, we have this Fabian method whereby the state ever so gradually comes to have more and more power. That's how we've seen it in Western Europe and the United States, not with a revolutionary Marxist one-shot event where all of a sudden the state has all power. It's rather a gradual process whereby the state acquires more and more power. It's not clear, Rothbard says, that state power can be diminished in the same way, in a gradual way, bit by bit. And part of the reason for that is that there are vested interests that want to keep the state the way it is, and there are vested interests that want to give the state more and more power, whereas the interests in reducing state power are much more dispersed and disorganized. So it's not clear that you can necessarily do it this way, that you could just, if you just keep making the maximalist demands, well, maybe you can do what the socialists have done, but in reverse, you can start reversing state power. He's not clear in a later essay that that's really doable, but certainly it can't hurt to have people who are just radically different from everybody else in the discussion. And that's certainly been helpful with monetary policy, but at least to have Ron Paul out there, who's radically different from everybody else in the discussion, saying we don't need a monetary policy. We don't need this type of intervention into the market economy. Or we don't need to bomb, starve, or sanction those people. We don't need to do any of those things. to have somebody totally outside of the discussion can in this day and age with the internet around, can have an influence. So, you know, whether or not that's the way to ultimate success, I don't know, but it can't hurt. So in other words, even though Rothbard later throws a little cold water on this idea that we might be able to gradually reduce state power, still, it can't hurt to be holding aloft the vision of a libertarian society. It worked for the Marxists holding up their vision, and we've got a pretty darn good vision. Another reason Rothbard says that the state has been so successful in increasing its power has to do with the crummy job conservatism had been doing. And that's a fun topic we're going to get to after we thank our sponsor. Hey, everybody, it's Tom Woods. And when I was looking for a great gift for my friend Michael Malice, whom you know from this show, I got him a Harry's shave set. I've had a great experience with Harry's. I get a nice close shave. I get my supplies sent to me. It's a beauty. And I knew Michael is also a man, so I'm going to give him this gift. And he loves it, too. Harry's got started when two ordinary guys just got fed up paying for overpriced razors. So they bought their own German factory, and Harry's was born. Well, the folks at Harry's are so confident that you're going to love their blades as much as Michael Malice and I do, they're going to send you their trial shave set for free when you sign up at harrys.com/woods. Just pay for shipping. That free trial set includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle, 5 precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover, a $13 value for free when you sign up, just cover shipping. How do you get that? Head over to harrys.com/woods right now. That's harrys.com/woods. Hey, everybody, it's Tom Woods, and I'm back here talking again about Rothbard and the case for radical idealism. He talks about conservatism, and he says the problem with conservatism is, by its very nature, it doesn't have a consistent set of principles because it disavows the very idea of ideology. And so conservatism can eventually become at home with all kinds of outrages against the free market and individual liberty, because after a while, these things become traditional. And so even the New Deal, even to mess with the New Deal for some conservatives would be to upset our sacred traditions. Blech, says Rothbard. No wonder we're not getting anywhere. Well, the other side of this discussion is just standing around writing abstruse treatises about nothing instead of saying, hey, stop doing this. How about no increases in state power for these principled reasons? And then Rothbard says further that we should not advocate or prefer a gradual as opposed to an immediate and rapid approach to our goal. Even though in practice we may wind up with a gradual approach, that shouldn't be what we're advocating. Because think of the way William Lloyd Garrison, the great abolitionist, thought of it. He said, gradualism in theory is perpetuity in practice. So you don't start with gradualism as your demand. In fact, Garrison himself, this is a great, I think, strategic point. Garrison said, urge immediate abolition as earnestly as we may, it will, alas, be gradual abolition in the end. We have never said that slavery would be overthrown by a single blow. That it ought to be, we shall always contend. So we advocate the overthrow of slavery, boom, in just one fell swoop. And yes, we may get gradualism in practice. But if we advocate gradualism in practice, we're never going to get anywhere. That's just the way the dynamics of society and politics work. And by the way, says Rothbard, it's not utopian. What we're advocating is not utopian, at least the way most people understand that term. And we shouldn't accept that dismissive word. He says, because really, when you look around at utopias as they've been proposed, they're always meant for people other than the ones who actually exist. They're always, what has to precede them is some kind of fundamental change in human nature. They're too pure for human beings as they exist in the world today. So, as Rothbard puts it, a utopian system is one that could not work even if everyone were persuaded to try to put it into practice. The utopian system could not work, could not sustain itself in operation. So he says, for example, communism, the utopian goal of the left. the abolition of specialization and the adoption of uniformity could not work even if everyone were willing to adopt it immediately. And that's because it violates the very nature of man and the world, especially the uniqueness and individuality of every person, of his abilities and interests, and because it would mean a drastic decline in the production of wealth, so much so as to doom the great bulk of the human race to rapid starvation and extinction. The libertarian doctrine, by contrast, is not utopian but eminently realistic, says Rothbard, because this is the only theory that's really consistent with the nature of man and the world. The libertarian does not deny the variety and diversity of man. He glories in it and seeks to give that diversity full expression in a world of complete freedom. And in doing so, he also brings about an enormous increase in productivity and in the living standards of everyone, which is an eminently practical result generally scorned by true utopians as evil materialism. And then moreover, what about people calling for limited government? How utopian is that? They have all of world history against them in terms of examples, right? Let's look at cases of limited government and what wound up happening with them. Time and time again, same result. And they stand there and say, if only we could get back to the Constitution, not bothering to ask themselves, maybe this is a lesson I should be learning. Maybe this original system couldn't work. Maybe there's a reason that I'm standing here vainly shouting into the wind about the Constitution. So we're the ones who are realistic about the nature of the state. We're the ones who say you can't limit this thing with a piece of paper. Now, let me get back to a point I made early on, which is that Rothbard is not hereby saying that we can't support any half measures that might be proposed. Sure, we can support those, but we don't start off by saying, my goal is a 3% rate reduction. We'll vote for the 3% rate reduction because it moves us in the right direction, but we don't start off the discussion by saying, let's have a 3% rate reduction. So Rothbard says, how can we know whether any halfway measure or transitional demand should be hailed as a step forward or condemned as an opportunistic betrayal? And he identifies two criteria that we ought to use. And the first one is, whatever the transitional demands, the ultimate end of liberty must always be held aloft as the desired goal. And two, that no steps or means we might support ever explicitly or implicitly contradict the ultimate goal. So a short-run demand might not go as far as we might like, but it should always be consistent with the final end. If not, the short-run goal will work against the long-run purpose, and then opportunistic liquidation of libertarian principle will have arrived. So when it comes to taxation, you absolutely can favor a cut in taxation, even though it doesn't go all the way to zero. You can favor that, but you can't favor replacing it with a new tax or an increased tax elsewhere, because that contradicts and undercuts the libertarian goal itself. So what about, okay, if we have a tax cut, though, we're going to get bigger federal deficits because the government's going to keep spending. So therefore, we should favor keeping the tax. And Rothbard says, no, we can't take the position that we should only favor tax cuts that are immediately matched with corresponding spending cuts. And we do hear some people saying that. Again, we got to keep the taxes because the government hasn't pledged or brought about spending cuts. But as Rothbard says, the time to oppose government expenditures is when the budget is being considered or voted upon. At that time, the libertarian should call for drastic slashes in expenditures as well. So the point is, government activity should be reduced wherever it can. So when taxes are being talked about, reduce those. When spending's being talked about, reduce that. Any opposition to a particular cut in taxes or expenditures, says Rothbard, is impermissible from the point of view of libertarianism. Now, Rothbard had plenty of other stuff to say about strategy, more specific stuff to say about strategy, and he had theories as to where change was likely to come from and how it was likely to occur, but we'll try and get to that in another episode. I did just want to run through this essay and give you some food for thought, because I actually wondered about, not that I favor taxation, but how do you handle that question of, if we get rid of the taxes, well, they're just going to borrow the money and spend it anyway, so is it kind of a wash? And so, you know, is maybe the urgency of reducing the taxes isn't so great because they're going to siphon resources out of society one way or the other. but I think he's got the right way of thinking about it. When we're talking about taxes, cut taxes. When the conversation turns to spending, cut the spending. I think that's the right way to think about it. So I'm going to put this essay up again, as I said, at tomwoods.com/1001. So you can look at it for yourselves, and I welcome your feedback in the comments at tomwoods.com/1001. I hope to see you at the 1000th episode event in Orlando on September 30th, 2017. Registration at tomwoods.com/Orlando. Bring a friend, tell your friends, help me spread the word, and you will make me a happy man. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.